This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As forest fires rage across the western half of North America, I prepared a special show for your summer listening. Last week, we heard three experts speaking at the American Association for the Advancement of Science meetup, and this week I pulled three of our best Radio EcoShock interviews on the new age of superfires. And there is a superfire raging right now in the Canadian Prairie province of Saskatchewan. In the north is a fire burning over 100,000 hectares, about 250,000 acres of boreal forest, the size of a small country. Our guest, John Betts, tells us about the new age of superfires, their causes, and what communities and individuals can do to reduce the risk of unstoppable fires in the age of global warming. I think the unreported fires in the far north of Alaska, Canada, and Russia are a big deal. These forests were once carbon storehouses, which now become an additional source of greenhouse gases. If the top of the world burns, vast quantities of once frozen life in peat moss and in permafrost can be turned into both carbon dioxide and methane. Everyone in the world needs to know about this story wherever you may live. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and welcome to another hot summer on Radio EcoShock. Are we entering the age of super forest fires? Our guest is John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association. He's in British Columbia, Canada, in the gorgeous lakeside town of Nelson, B.C. John, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Is there a potential for super fires?
Yeah, I think there is a potential. And to kind of answer your question, not to shorten the interview by any regards, but I think we've already entered the era of super fires, both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, what we're beginning to see are fires of unusual intensity, severity, frequency, and so on, occurring in different forest types across the world. Again, I'm most familiar with what's occurring here in B.C. and in parts of the U.S., but certainly we're seeing the same tendency in Australia. The other thing that adds more severity to these and sort of brings with it a whiff of catastrophe is the fact that human habitat has been encroaching into these forest ecosystems, which are in a certain, we'll talk about a little later, but they're in a not a great state to begin with. And once you begin to embed human habitat like homes and so forth, as well as infrastructure like watersheds and transmission corridors, quite a lot of values are at stake. And so we're seeing loss of infrastructure and lives as well. And communities are being destroyed by wildfire on a scale we haven't seen before either.
Well, so what is new about these fires? We've had fire for centuries. What's new about these?
Well, I referred to intensity and severity. So those are, I don't want to dwell too much on the technicalities of it, but intensity refers to the energy a fire releases, and severity is the duration, to put it simply, the damage it does in the duration of time it spends burning. What we're seeing, because of the available fuels, and this is a term I'm going to come back to this, because there's so much more wood on the landscape to burn, we're seeing fires burn, as I said, with more energetically, with longer durations, with increasing frequency, and also spreading at quite higher rates than we've typically seen. So fire behavior in many locales around the planet is changed significantly. Plus, these fires are beginning to take on a capacity to be destructive, not only to the communities that we have built in them, but they actually are starting to damage the ecosystems that they are part of themselves. They're actually doing long-term damage to the habitat. These fires are burning well out of the sort of normal range of variability that we might see.
Right. You told Justine Hunter of the Globe and Mail newspaper these fires can burn so hot they actually sterilize the ground. Does that mean nothing much grows back there for a while, or not a forest, or what?
That can occur, and it has to do with the structure of the fuels. In other words, just exactly what is catching fire. I think I need to step back a bit to explain just how that can occur. And I'll use BC as an example. We've had an outbreak here of the mountain pine beetle, which has affected approximately 15 million hectares, or close to about, say, twice that in terms of acres, so 30 million acres of land has been either degraded or destroyed, meaning the standing trees are pretty much all dead, across a huge area of British Columbia. So what happens then is those trees stand for some time, maybe depending on the location and the weather and so forth, but within about 10 years, they start to break down. I mean, obviously, they dry out and desiccate, they crack and they check, the bark comes off, other little bugs and beetles get in there after the mountain pine beetle. It's a bit of a heyday maybe for woodpeckers for a while, but basically, the stand then begins to break down and fall into itself. It may lean up against other trees, or if they're live, if it's a mixed stand, it may lean up against live trees, or they fall onto the ground and form a kind of a jackstrawed matrix of fuel. Well, that area then, that creates, if you can picture that in your mind, when that catches on fire, and you've all built bonfires and so forth and figured out when you sort of stack your sticks in a certain way, you can get a really good fire going. Well, I'm oversimplifying some, but the gist of it is the fuel is across a large portion of the landscape here and in many other parts of continental U.S. and other parts. The fuel is now structured to burn quite differently than it would normal if it was a normal standing forest. So, and when that happens, the fires burn for a long time, and the heat is radiated down into the soil, and it's in that soil that all the little enzymes, bacteria, seeds, and so forth that under a normal healthy fire regime would simply resprout and come back actually get killed off.
Well, as you say, this isn't just a problem for British Columbia. People from Colorado all the way to Australia, even Spain, face the threat of superfires. John Betts, you were just at a fire meeting. Can you tell us what it was and some of the things that you heard there?
Well, our association, the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association, hosted a major international wildfire conference in Kelowna, British Columbia, just a few weeks back. And what we did was we brought speakers in, experts in the wide range of areas of interest around communities and wildfire. And we brought speakers from Australia, United States, Canada, British Columbia. And they spoke to a wide range of issues. Our purpose here was to make British Columbians aware, and particularly community leaders, to appreciate the problem that we're seeing grow on the landscape right now. I think there's still some simplistic thinking, which is forgivable given the weight of responsibilities that municipal and provincial governments have upon them. But the notion that we can deal with wildfires as we have done traditionally through suppression, and that's all we need to do about it. Well, of course, what we're seeing in these fires, and it's been certainly some of the people who are saying this loudest are the suppression people, is that these are fires that we really can't put out. So to rely on suppression as a way of protecting neighborhoods and all the infrastructure I just described, both community-related as well as industries that are embedded in the forest as well, we need to be thinking of different strategies to how we manage the land. To put it simply, we need to take the fuel out of the forest that's going to contribute to these catastrophic wildfires. And that was the purpose of the conference, was to expose people to all the various aspects of this. I mean, we covered everything from home insurance, like what effect are catastrophic wildfires having on the home insurers in the U.S., and will that travel up to Canada? Will those same effects be held here? We talked about what kind of buildings need to be built and what materials need to be used and what do you have to do around your own house or in your community, and what needs to be done out on the landscape to mitigate the effects of these hazardous, these very dangerous wildfires. So we covered quite a lot of ground. We tracked it over 200 individuals from across BC, Alberta, far away actually as Australia as well, who have an interest in this topic. So we think this kind of discussion needs to really happen, because the remedies are going to be found not just in protection and emergency response, but in what programs do we undertake to remove the fuels that are threatening communities? How do we pay for that? Is there value in the biomass that we're removing? Could that possibly be used to heat schools or create bioenergy fuels? What kind of creative responses do we need to that? And, you know, a whole range of issues. We wanted to emphasize that to deal with wildfire threat, we need to take a holistic approach.
Right. Well, the old theory of forest management, and it was pushed by parks management and some greens as well, was just leave that fallen wood as part of the cycle of building forest soils. Your association does have an interest in changing that to remove more of the dead wood and the undergrowth. Is that right?
Yes. And, you know, but it's interesting to remark that in the national forests in BC and Alberta have very active programs of managing for wildfire, which include removing trees. Heaven forbid, I'm not going to say the word logging in the parks. But they've realized that they have a huge problem there in terms of the fact that many of the landscapes there have been denied fire. I should go back and emphasize that one of the primary causes of this threat is the fact that we've been suppressing fire effectively for quite a few decades. And the outcome of that is that the forests have missed their normal cycles of fire. So now when we get fires, and there's no reason to believe we're not going to have them, they tend to burn, as I said, with intensities and severities and frequencies we have not seen before. So rather than risk the parks going up in smoke in the worst way possible, they're doing a combination of things. In some cases, they're lighting fires to simply reintroduce fire into the landscape. In some cases, they're coming in and thinning trees out and removing excess vegetation with the idea of, in fact, opening up grazing land that was lost to some of the ungulates that live in the parks because the trees have encroached on them because of the fire suppression. So we're seeing some of the most cutting-edge approach actually coming from the national parks. So there's a difference between some woody biomass needed to replenish the soil and removing the fuels that are, in fact, capable of destroying the soils.
Well, the fire threat can be terrifying when it reaches towns or cities. Could you tell our listeners about some of the incidents that have happened in British Columbia?
Well, of course, our conference was done in a sense to, I was going to use the word celebrate, but I guess that's not the right word, to remember the 2003 fires in Kelowna. And that was a very significant event, maybe a turning point in our appreciation of wildfire, although I have sometimes reasons to doubt whether we've really learned everything we needed. But we lost a couple of hundred homes in that neighborhood. We lost others in other communities, Barriere, north of Kelowna. We've lost some in the East Kootenays. It was a very bad year that year. But it's well worth noting that in just the Okanagan alone, in fact, just last year, there was a fire in a small community across from Kelowna called Trepanier Creek, which nearly destroyed, it did destroy part of that community, a very fast-moving, wind-driven fire that had an effect, nearly took out a shopping plaza and a number of homes and so on. So, and it behaved very differently than what we've expected. So we continue to see fires of that kind of severity and potentially catastrophic on a regular basis. Of course, in Alberta, Slave Lake is a huge fire event that everyone, I think the 40% of that community was destroyed by fire, and they're still rebuilding that community today. And of course, down in Colorado, to draw attention back there, because there are some very strong parallels between Colorado and some of the forest types we have here. They had a dreadful year just last year in Colorado Springs and the Waldo Canyon fire and so forth, where we saw again hundreds of homes destroyed in what would look, most of us would think were suburbs. They didn't obviously seem to be really embedded in the forest to the extent that we might think of when we normally talk about, you know, communities that are built into the forest. So we've got a history here. It goes back, I think, in 1998 in BC, we had our first big warning. There was a fire near Salmon Arm. And what it did is it spotted sparks some few kilometers down into the community. And that's another thing that we need to be well aware of. Your neighborhood may not be right up against the woods, but the thing that tends to destroy communities are the burning embers. And some of them, we know, have blown 3-4 kilometers, and I've heard unconfirmed reports that they might even sometimes carry twice that distance. So they're capable of starting fires just by spotting. And we've seen that in a kind of a quiet little fire a few years ago up in the north of BC called the Binta Lake Fire. And then as a cold front pushed through, a cold low front pushed through, which it turns out is very conducive to creating big wildfires, that fire moved 20 kilometers in one day. So if you put that into the fire shed that I live in here in Nelson, which is an east-west valley, which is the way the winds tend to blow, that's a pretty scary phenomenon to see happen. And frankly, where I live, we've got woods built up, or that I wouldn't say that's out of the range of possibility.
Yeah, I've seen video in California where the fire just races over the hill out of sight before you can snap your fingers practically, and no human's going to get in there in time to stop it. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with John Betts from the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in Canada. And John, when I visited some communities surrounded by these dead pine forests, the discussion quickly turns to metal roofs for the very reason that you just brought up. Those dropping embers can start a fire right in the town. Should we be cutting down trees for fire breaks around the towns and cities? That's a very hot debate right now.
Well, I you pick my words carefully here. You may have to take some trees down, but it doesn't mean you have to denude the landscape. But let's go back to what you just said about the homes. Let's face it, in many cases, you look at the pictures, you'll often see the homes are burnt down, but the adjacent trees haven't. So the inference you can draw from that is that that home was more flammable and more prone to catching on fire than the actual adjacent trees. So I think the first thing you've got to do is make sure that you've got fireproof roofs. And metal roofs are one example, but there are all kinds of different materials that can be used. And in fact, going back to Colorado and the fires I mentioned in the Waldo Canyon, tens of thousands of roofs have been changed in those neighborhoods and are continuing to be changed. So you've got to make your house, to some extent, fire adapted. So you change the roof, You've got to clean your eaves out, too. Again, the eaves and valleys of your roof tend to accumulate materials. You can find out how to do all this through programs like in Canada, it's called Fire Smart Canada. In the United States, you can go to FireWise Communities or Fire Adapted Communities Coalition. Both of those programs are well known, and you can learn about what you can do to your own home. The community then needs to take some responsibility for what is the best thing to do around your neighborhood. Then that's where you got into sort of having to decide. You need to have fire experts come in. It isn't just, like I said, a question of cutting down every tree, but you're going to have to look at slope aspect, the previous fire history, the grasses. Remember that the other thing about cutting trees down is that within 4 or 5 years, things grow back up. So there's a kind of a long-term strategy. So it would be simplistic to say cutting trees down, but you need to actively manage the landscape around your community. And that could involve a number of things. Basically, what I'm saying here is that we can learn to live with fire if we design our communities in the right way and if we design our homes in the right way, and we also get active even further out on the landscape to modify, create fire fuel breaks, if you will, through how we log, how we harvest, and so forth, and begin to make it so the fire can actually pass through a neighborhood and we can simply, I'm oversimplifying a bit, but return to it and find that the neighborhood isn't destroyed, the trees aren't all gone, there's been a fast-moving fire that we knew was coming, got out of the way, are able to keep our homes from burning down and actually learn to live with every few years fire coming through if you're in an active fire management area. And of course, the frequency and return intervals would differ depending on the forest types and climate and so forth.
And I guess, too, some of it may be just really consider whether you want to go off and live in the woods. As you mentioned, some of the suburbs are expanding into areas and some people are building way back. Maybe your choice of where you're going to live could be important if the regime is changing.
Yeah, and now the insurance industry in the U.S., which hasn't really taken a whole lot of interest in wildfire compared to what they lose through tornadoes and hurricanes and other calamities. But they're starting to pay close attention to this. And that's one indicator that, just along the lines you said, Alex, that people are going to have to start thinking about when you move in, when you bring your flush toilet, if you will, out to the wilderness and park your home out there and start up your lawnmower. Remember, you're in a fire-based ecosystem. And, you know, you have a right to live there, but you got a duty to sort of figure out what that means. And that may mean that you can't have the nice pine tree hanging over top of your porch or your roof. It may mean that you've got to think about whether that you're actually in a healthy forest and is there some things you can do to make it healthier. And that's a really important view to have. Because we've interrupted the natural cycles of disturbance, because we're experiencing we seem to have the symptoms of global warming at play, which is just sort of adding fuel to the fire, we need to be taking all of those things into consideration and learning also. We've introduced ourselves. We're well embedded in this. With that goes a responsibility to sort of live intelligently on the land, figure out whether your home is fire adapted. Don't be reliant on simply being bailed out by helicopters full of fire retardant. Take responsibility for your landscape and your expectations in that area.
Well, John, you raised global warming, and I know that you end up talking to mill owners and workers and loggers. Do they generally understand the role of global warming in the pine bark beetle, that the winters just are too warm and didn't kill them off, or do they still consider it some kind of green plot? What's your take on that?
I think people to be honest with you, I don't think global warming has actually played its hand yet. Yes, we've had a series of warm years where the beetle was allowed to survive in numbers we don't normally see, and that's an important factor. But I'm saying in a way that the landscape was about to sort of give out in some respect. Either it was going to be the mountain pine beetle or huge fires or something, because we had allowed the forest to depart so far from their normal regime. If you add global warming to this, and I think people understand that some people take the mountain pine beetle as a literal expression of global warming. I'm taking a more nuanced view, but what I'm saying is certainly the longer fire seasons, like we're adding 30 days to our fire seasons in parts of BC, clearly there's a trend going on here, and I don't think anyone's denying that. And in fact, I would say that the lumber logging industry has a very strong interest in fully understanding wildfire, global warming, and the effects it's going to have on their ability to simply harvest wood off this landscape.
Do you think we're going to be able to adapt our silviculture and maintain the ecology of forests and the business of forestry, even if we get, you know, these record high heats as they did in Australia, for example?
I'm afraid I'm being cast so many times as the sort of fatalistic prophet of doom, but let me switch channels briefly. We have still a window to do intelligent things on the landscape. There are moments when it seems the pace of events, the catastrophic events, seem to really be able to, as you've mentioned, that fire that went across the horizon before we could notice it. Clearly, I think there are times when I wonder if we're going to keep up. But I think there are things that we can do, and we can start at our home, we can spread out through our communities. We can at least begin to make sure that our neighborhoods and watersheds, and I use the term fire shed, are protected. We can start with that. And I think out of that, I'm going to be optimistic, which is untypical, but I think we can actually generate an economy around reducing the hazard that currently we face in the forests in many of the parts of the world. And that we can take some of that biomass that I'm saying needs to be removed and convert it, as I said earlier, into the economy as to make products. Maybe that would then overcome the biggest obstacle here is how do you pay for all of this work that needs to be done to undo the consequences of how we've managed our forest to date. It's a huge debt, but there may be ways to do it. And I have to take the optimistic view, because as you mentioned in the outset, I do live in a very nice place on the shores of Kootenai Lake, and I have a vested interest personally in not going up in smoke. And I'm hoping that if we can get other communities and individuals and leaders, both at the state, federal, provincial levels, to take leadership on this, we can actually save the economy a lot of money. Because one of the consequences of fire is that you may hear sums of hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to suppress fire. But the long-term costs of fire are in many cases, as studies now show, 10, 20, 30 times that. If you blow out a major watershed to a major community, the consequences of that to rebuild that infrastructure artificially is huge. If you are beset with the degradation of the landscape so that you have floods and mudslides and so on, the cost of that, the health costs, the interruptions to the economy, the long-term consequences, which I don't even know how you'd put a measurement on, of having destroyed ecosystems. When you've actually burned an area off to the point where the only thing that can come in is opportunistic invasive plants, how do you put a cost on that? So there are huge costs that are associated with this, and I'm taking the view that I'm hoping that we can get out ahead of this. I'd say we've got 10, 15 years, and after that, I would not be so optimistic.
And I'm thinking most of these dead forests are going to burn, releasing more gigatons of carbon into the atmosphere. Do you think most of it will burn? And if you had to make a guess, when would the years of the giant forest fires come?
You know, if we go back to Yellowstone in 1988, I think that was 300,000 hectares. That was the equivalent of three times in one fire, three times what we would normally burn in all of British Columbia. And British Columbia could easily hold the state of Texas with a lot of room left over inside. So it gives you a sense of the size of it. We've already seen huge fires already. And it was interesting that certainly mountain pine beetle degraded forests were a factor in the Yellowstone fire. So if I'm saying that British Columbia and other large swathes of the landscape throughout continental U.S. and so on, at least in the coniferous forests, are subject to the same thing, it could happen as soon as 6 weeks or 2 months from now here in Canada when we enter sort of into the drying trend. If the jet stream sets up there in the, within 3 or 4 weeks, by just July or August, I hate to sound like this, but it's the truth, Alex, we are in a position to have terrifically huge wildfires after about 6 weeks of dry weather here in British Columbia and many other places.
I think it could come this year or next year, in the next several years. It more or less has to happen. That's just my opinion. You know, last spring I interviewed one of Canada's top fire experts, Dr. Michael Flanagan from the University of Alberta, and he told us that further north, the soil is so thin, it only takes 3 hot days to reach high fire risk, even after a period of heavy rains. 3 days, the forest can burn. How does that compare with your experience further south?
Yeah, you'd have to talk to fire behavior experts, but my understanding here is the lighter fuels do dry out very quickly. They can then carry fire quite well. So the larger fuels take a little longer to dry out, obviously. But the way things are configured here in BC, let's just say if we went through a cycle like we did a decade or so ago where we had about 4 or 5 years of relatively dry years. And then I think that, you know, after El Nino and these sort of effects, the dryness tends to accumulate, and especially if you go back to that fuel matrix I described earlier where the wood is kind of stacked. In some cases, that wood isn't even covered in the snow. So, and no one's going to, we haven't really quantified this in any manner that I can understand, but it may, like I said, fire experts can perhaps help you with that question. But I'm saying that it doesn't take much to burn here, and it isn't the same fire type. But I mentioned the Trepanier fire in back in near Kelowna just last year. That fire moved very quickly on a very light fuel load that was largely pine needles underneath a closed canopy of lodgepole pine. With the wind and the dry needles, that was produced a very dangerous fire that moved very quickly into a neighborhood. So we are seeing, as I said, fire behavior that we've never quite anticipated and are just beginning to try to figure out the models to predict. So we're straying into some unknown territory here, but the balance of probability is in favor of anyone that wants to say we're going to, as I have been saying, see increasingly large fires, increasingly frequent fires, increasingly intense and severe, and the catastrophic outcomes will be felt in many areas, economically, socially, and so forth, and they will be enduring. This is one of our largest challenges I think we face in British Columbia. Much is being said about the timber down shortfall and so forth. But in the past, we used to fight over things around parks versus clear cuts. This is a challenge of such complexity on such a scale that some of the old positions and the old thinking really isn't a match for it. And we're going to have to find new ways of approaching these problems.
We have been talking with John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in British Columbia, Canada. You can find links to his organization and some of the stories we've been discussing in my show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You've tuned in to the best of Radio EcoShock. This week I've selected three of our best interviews on the new age of superfires and the impacts of climate change on forest fires in the far north. We are honored to have with us S. Tom Gower, the University of Wisconsin-Madison Professor of Forest Ecology. He's been studying the role of Canada's northern boreal forest and climate change. Professor Gower, in a University of Wisconsin science report for 2006 and 2007, you are quoted as saying, increased plant growth means the boreal forest will take in more carbon dioxide and may actually become a stronger carbon sink. But now your new article in Nature magazine for November 1st seems to contradict that, saying the boreal forest is a net source of greenhouse gases. What has changed your mind?
Basically, this most recent analysis using model simulation and accounting for increased disturbance across the landscape in northern Manitoba has shown us that wildfire has basically changed the system from a carbon sink, that is, taking up more carbon than it's releasing, to a carbon source. So it really now is sort of contributing to rising atmospheric CO2 concentrations.
Do you think you could summarize your paper's conclusions for us so that we understand it a bit better?
Yeah, I can try. We basically took a ecosystem process model that simulates carbon, nitrogen, and water, and we've really looked at using historic climate data, how changes in climate over this almost 60-year period affected the sort of the net exchange of carbon dioxide between the boreal forest and the atmosphere. And then we used historic fire records to also estimate CO2 emissions due to wildfires. And what we found is that the climate, there were good years and we'd see more uptake of CO2 by the forest, and there were bad years and we'd see less carbon taken up by the forest. But overall, it sort of oscillated around some long-term mean without any long or dramatic changes. But the effects of fire on the simulation clearly showed this sort of downward steady trend of the forest taking up less and less carbon. In fact, it went from roughly 60 years ago, a system that this 1,000-by-1,000-kilometer grid taking up carbon to, at the end of the simulation, actually releasing CO2 or contributing to rising atmospheric CO2 concentrations.
So I guess we've seen the photos of fires in California. Are we to imagine that in Canada's north there are forest fires that just rage every summer and nobody knows about it, nobody hears about it?
Oh, absolutely. I always chuckle because the fires in heavily populated areas, typically the western U.S. where fire is very prevalent, get lots of publicity, but they're really quite small in size compared to the fires that burn in the boreal regions of Canada, Alaska, and Eurasia, mainly Siberia. I mean, there's just large fires that occur. And in the late 1980s, a fire in northeast China burned a little over 1 million hectares in one fire.
The Black Dragon Fire.
So, you know, these fires are enormous in size. They're really difficult, both logistically and economically, to fight or to combat. And they do consume, you know, large areas. I know in 95, I think it was, I was in Manitoba working. There were 60 or 70 some odd wildfires burning during the month. So it is a very fire-prone system. I mean, fire is a natural part of the ecology of boreal forest.
Well, I think ecologists have presumed in the past that, well, yes, there are big fires. They are natural. They happened before humans came here. But it'll grow back, and things will be good again. But are we now seeing the potential for a positive feedback loop due to climate change, that these fires could leave a lasting result?
That's clearly what the model suggests, because as you go from, you know, accumulating carbon to now releasing carbon, what that's really saying is it's putting more greenhouse gases back into the atmosphere, which cause additional warming, which make the forest even more susceptible to wildfires. And as you've accurately described, we now have a positive feedback loop set up. Now, how long that continues remains to be seen, but it's an important point to make. Fire is a natural component of these boreal systems and a number of other forest biomes, but we now are no longer in that steady state condition. We've moved to some new state, and I think that's reason to be concerned.
I think one important point that hasn't really reached the public as it should, I'm just starting to grasp it, is the pivotal role of soil. And it's in your study, and it's in other scientists that I've talked to about all the living and dead biological life that's in the northern soil that could be released as carbon or as methane if it's wet. Do you think this melting northern soil could deliver an unexpected punch of greenhouse gases to us?
Well, that was one of the key questions we had when we were doing this study is that there was some work done in Alaska showing that when these wildfires occur, immediately after that, you get this large release of CO2, mainly because you've got more energy reaching the surface and you speed up decomposition. We did not see that we actually did measurements at a whole variety of different age stands. And we never saw any indication of that. I'd even offer a bit more evidence. I've also got an experimental warming site up in Thompson where we're heating the soil 5 degrees above ambient to, again, test this effect of climate change on the release of CO2 and other greenhouse gases from the soil. And we have not seen any sort of significant increase in CO2 from the warm soil. So it potentially could be a very important threshold, but the fire study as well as the warming study really are not showing that to date.
Well, I wonder, we've seen this startling melt of the Arctic ice sheet this summer, and there has been a lot of talk about what happens if the permafrost melts. But so far in your studies, you haven't seen that's happening right now.
That's right, and I've certainly am familiar with the many of those are tundra sites. And they provide a pretty convincing argument that those systems are responding much more dramatically than what we've seen in the boreal forest. But, you know, in those cases, permafrost is sitting maybe 30 centimeters below the soil surface, while in our systems, we either have discontinuous permafrost or no permafrost that we can tell. So a little bit different comparisons.
Now, as I understand it, your studies are based on a large area in northern Manitoba. Is there someone, or even yourself, preparing to study the whole Canadian North and figure out the greenhouse gas emissions coming from wildfires there?
Well, a number of people have sort of done some, I'll call, spreadsheet calculations, just looking at area burn and CO2 emissions. Werner Kurtz there in D.C. is probably one of the world's experts, if not the world expert. And I know he's put together a whole carbon budget for the Canadian forest. So he certainly is recognized as a world leader in some of these calculations.
We're talking with Professor Tom Gower from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Where can people find out more about your work?
Well, it's on the Nature homepage right now. That's the journal that was published in. We also have it highlighted on my homepage. It's highlighted by the National Science Foundation, which is the funding agency that provided funds. That's basically Canada's equivalent to NSERC. And it's also highlighted at the University of Wisconsin homepage as well. So a number of places.
Not hard to find. Well, you know, Tom, we're all trying to figure this one out. We're almost trying to peer into the future, even though science can really only tell us about the present and the past. But do you have some predictions for the future of the boreal forest and its impacts on the overall climate system?
Well, that's probably our next big focus, as we would with this experimental warming site. We hope to be able to begin to understand how the carbon cycle of the forest may change in a warmer climate. We would also like to use models to predict how wildfire frequency might change in a warmer climate, and then probably couple those together and say, okay, now with future climate forecasts, what will the new boreal forest look like as far as carbon uptake and interaction with the atmosphere? So that's sort of where we're heading, hopefully, in the next 5 years, assuming we can get funding to do something like that.
Is there something we've missed, a message you'd like to get across to people tracking developing climate change?
No, I had one person say, oh, the forests are not good anymore. Well, no, that's not the case. The forests are still trying to take up CO2. It's just that the disturbance regime has increased so dramatically that it's really diminishing their ability to offset rising atmospheric CO2 concentrations. So the trees are still doing their job. It's just that they're being disturbed more frequently, and we think that the increased wildfire frequency is due to combustion of fossil fuels.
We've been talking with Professor Tom Gower, who just published an article in the November 1st, 2007 issue of Nature magazine with startling new evidence about the boreal forest and wildfires in climate change. Thank you for taking this time to talk with us today.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
All right. I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Regular EcoShock listeners know wildfires in the Arctic are bigger and badder than ever. Scientists predict a huge increase over the coming decades due to changes in climate and various feedbacks triggered by global warming. Could the whole boreal forest burn down? New research has taken us deeper into fire behavior in the far north. The paper that caught my eye is titled Resistance of the Boreal Forest to High Burn Rates. Our next guest is one of the authors, Marc-André Parisien, is a research scientist for the Northern Forest Center of the Canadian Fire Service, located in Edmonton, Alberta. Mark, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, Mark, most of us can barely imagine the size and the way this great boreal forest is. How big is it, and what would it be like to be there?
Well, it's a pretty big place. It's about 1.7 square kilometers, so that's just over half of the landmass of Canada. And, of course, I'm very biased, but I think it's a wonderful place. It's very humbling to know that I'm hundreds of kilometers away from any kind of human settlement or roads, and I find it both scary and appeasing. It's a forest that's very green, where there's lots of water, and because it's so far north, there's all this great light all summer. But it's also a fire ecologist's paradise, because it's a forest that's been shaped by large and intense wildfires. And when I was there in the last few years, last 3 years, we were working and living in the smoke for most of our time up in the Northwest Territories. Perhaps unpleasant for some people, but I thought it was great.
Did you mean 1.7 million square kilometers, or what was the size? I'm sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, it's 1.7 million square kilometers.
Okay. Now, as you know, television doesn't really report on fires in Canada's far north the way they do city fires, and most of these blazes run their course, as far as I can tell, with no one trying to put them out. How big can a fire get?
Well, they get huge, hundreds of thousands of hectares. So if you think of Manhattan, that's 9,000 hectares. There was a forest fire in Quebec a couple years ago that was recorded as 560,000 hectares. There's been several in the Northwest Territories and, of course, in Siberia this summer that were hundreds of thousands of hectares. They are very, very large, and altogether, they can burn millions of hectares in Canada. This summer, I guess we're at about 4.6 million hectares just in Canada.
So a single fire might be bigger than a European country, for example.
Well, 4.6 million hectares is quite a bit larger than Switzerland, so pretty fair chunk of land.
So looking at the future, what is the range of predicted increase in the area burned each year as we reach the end of the 21st century?
Well, it does vary a lot among regions and among studies, but the range we found in the literature was 30 to 500%.
That's stunning. 500%, that wouldn't leave much of the forest left, would it?
It would not.
Well, now, how do we know global warming is a big factor behind this increase in boreal forest fires?
Well, we know because the link between weather and its long-term average climate is pretty well understood. And because the highest recorded increases in temperatures have been observed at high latitudes, we've been able to track some of these changes and establish pretty solid correlation over the last 50-100 years. This said, climate's not the only factor. The boreal forest is an increasingly busy place, and humans are certainly affecting some of the fire regimes there.
And one of the key discoveries made, and this study was led by scientists from the University of Quebec, was to find a kind of braking system that could limit fires in the far north. We just talked about 500%, there wouldn't be much left, but maybe there's something that could stop that from happening. But before we reach that conclusion, can you tell us why and how you did this study?
Sure. So in the boreal forest of North America, it's been assumed that fires burn independently of the age of the forest stand, which is really the time since the last fire. In other words, forests that burned just a few years ago are just as likely to burn than those forests that burned 100 years ago. Now, it's been our intuition that this is not the case. Recent burns do indeed limit where and how future fires burn. This may be irrelevant where there's not a whole lot of fires on the landscape, but it may be very important in those parts of the boreal forest that have been just plastered with fires over the last few decades. So we set out to sample one of those areas by reconstructing past fires. And specifically, what we looked at is overlapping fires over the last 200 years, over a 190-kilometer transect in northern Quebec. This allowed us to determine if fires tend to reburn or overlap randomly, or if recent fires don't burn quite as often as would be predicted by chance alone.
So from your research, what is, if any, the limit to the amount of forest that burns?
Well, it's safe to say that the influence of weather on fires is pretty well understood. We know that fires burn when it's hot, when it's dry, when it's windy. What's less well understood is the likelihood of what it is on the ground, the vegetation, to burn. And this study, I believe, provides a piece of that puzzle. Basically, in our study area, forests that burned 40 to 50 years ago are less likely to reburn than older forests. So when you've burned, you've got a few decades there where you may still burn. This study is not saying that it is impossible that young forests reburn, but they do at a much lesser rate than old forests.
Okay. Now, moving to a different topic, when I interviewed Dr. Michael Flanagan a couple of years ago, he told us fires can burn so hot and so deep, perhaps into the peat in the ground, that the soil is sterilized, leaving nothing to grow back. Have you seen or heard of this phenomenon, and is it a concern?
Well, in various parts of Canada, I've heard of areas being deforested. In fact, I've seen many of them. And that's not only in peatlands, but also in upland forests. If these situations become more common, there's no doubt to me that people will start getting concerned, whether it's from a standpoint of socioeconomics, carbon dynamics, or protecting the ecological integrity. And some of these areas truly look like moonscapes. You've had a fire, say, 20 years ago, and another fire not too long after that, and the trees just don't have time to rebound, and there's no seeds on site to regenerate.
And I understand some fires can even create their own weather systems, complete with winds or even thunder. Can you tell us about that?
Well, absolutely. It's just mind-boggling how much energy is transferred in some of these large fires. Fires can create a really impressive convection column that just rolls onto the landscape and indeed creates its own weather with sometimes rain, sometimes lightning, and sometimes even fire whirls, which are little fire tornadoes.
You wouldn't want to see one of those close up.
No.
All right. Now, for me, the key here is whether this balancing of forest and wildfires that you talk about in your paper could save the boreal forests as a functioning ecosystem, even with the abnormally hot temperatures we expect to develop in the north over time. Have you given that some thought?
Yeah, and there's no easy answer here. I think it's hard to tell because fire is not the only factor. You can have some major changes in hydrology, in tree growth, in the distribution of forest pests, like mountain pine beetle. If you think of a major thaw of permafrost, for example, that'll have huge impacts on your ecosystems up there. And fire will invariably interact with these altered systems, and they'll create new, novel forest dynamics. But what are the outcomes? They're highly uncertain.
So we're rolling the dice. We don't know what's going to happen.
We know part of the story, but incrementally, we're trying to figure it out.
Would your research apply just as well to forests and fires in Siberia?
You know, I'm not sure. The Siberian boreal forest is a different beast altogether. It's quite different from the North American boreal forest. So I think we can be cautious and say, to what extent does this negative feedback apply to the Siberian boreal forest? We don't really know just yet.
And I want to pick up on something that showed up in a couple of blogs. It appears from satellite photos taken in early August that there was a wildfire right near the Laptev Sea in Siberia. That's so far north, there are no trees. How would a fire be possible there?
Well, it is possible. And we're also seeing more and more of these fires in the tundra in North America. Basically, if all the ingredients are there, an ignition source, biomass to burn, and fire-conducive weather, any type of vegetation can experience pretty large wildfires. And perhaps you don't have a lot of trees burning up there, but you can have a lot of peat burning, you can have a lot of shrubs burning, you can have a lot of grasses burning, but they do seem to be becoming more and more common.
This is Radio EcoShock with my guest Marc-André Parisien, a research scientist with the Canadian Fire Service. Mark, in our winter of 1997-98, gigantic peat fires in Indonesia propelled that country to become the world's third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. It was a huge burst of carbon, and then burning peat was also found in the deadly Russian heat wave of 2010. Could we see another big burst of carbon if Arctic peat catches fire on a big scale?
Possibly, but I think there's a lot more peat burning in the boreal forest than in the Arctic per se. And during those big fire years in the boreal forest, so years like this year, the boreal forest is a fairly important carbon source rather than a carbon sink. So it emits more carbon than it actually assimilates.
And are you aware of any scientist or paper that has attempted to calculate the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere from wildfires in Canada's north?
Yeah, there are several researchers working on this. One of them is a colleague of mine, Brian Amiro. At the Canadian Forest Service, we try to calculate emissions from fires. So I've got some colleagues, Ron Hall, Werner Kurtz, that are working on this. And there's also several American colleagues that are working on this question, folks like Merit Turetsky and Eric Kosciuszko. So it's a very important field of study, and I think we're getting closer to understanding it every year.
Does Canada offer statistics and satellite photos online for the public so we can tune into this?
Absolutely. So we've got a fairly nice site at the Canadian Forest Service, if I'm allowed a little bit of blatant self-promotion. It's called the Canadian Wildland Information System, and I'd be happy to give you the web link if you'd like.
I would like that. If you could send it to me, I'll put it in my blog at ecoshock.info so people can tune into it. It's probably got quite a long URL, does it?
It does have a fairly long URL.
Okay.
I'd better just send it to you.
Send it to me in email. I'll stick it on the blog at ecoshock.info. So listeners, you can pick it up there every Wednesday that blog gets published. So I've been reading about the feedback loops from forest fires in high latitudes. For example, soot can blacken the snow and ice. That leads to earlier melt, longer fire seasons, more fires. Are there other feedback loops, and are scientists trying to study these complex effects of the fires?
Well, nature often has lots of checks and balances and that create positive and negative feedbacks. And there are some groups working on that. They're fairly complex models because nature is fairly complicated. But I would say that generally the jury is still out whether fires in some cases can create net warming or net cooling, because there's certainly all kinds of feedbacks that can affect your fire carbon dynamics here.
Right. I mean, smoke from fires actually reduces the amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the ground for a little while anyway. So that's a bit of a cooling effect there.
Yeah. Now, is it a negligible or a measurable effect? I'm not sure. I'm not a carbon guy per se, but I have a kind of a general knowledge of what's going on.
Okay. Now, are there differences between a wildfire in the boreal, such as you study, or even further north, compared to the big wildfires we've seen this year in California or Washington State?
Well, keeping in mind that wildfires are extremely variable, I would say that, yes, there are fairly important differences. One fundamental difference is that boreal fires tend to kill most of the trees, whereas fires in the dry forest of the western U.S. Do not. There's more of a mixed severity there, kills some trees, but many of the bigger trees do survive the fire.
That's an important difference. So, Marc-André Prisien, if we determine the boreal forest ecosystem is in danger from increasing wildfires as the world continues to heat, is there anything we could do to intervene or to prevent or fight these fires?
Well, given the size of the boreal forest, our mitigation actions would only be limited and fairly localized. However, some of the bigger threats to ecological integrity may not come from the forest fires, but change in the physical environment, such as permafrost melting or forest pests, or simply the climatic stress on plants. And I think that's an active area of research.
And looking at the whole fire system in the north, in your opinion, what kind of research still needs to be done as a priority?
Well, that's a little bit in the eye of the beholder, Alex, but I think we need to pursue our work on how to better understand where, when, and how fires tend to burn. Once we have a greater knowledge of these dynamics, we can predict the changes to come and derive some sensible adaptation strategies. Also, I'd say that given how important fire is to the boreal forest dynamics, we need to know more about the human impacts on fire regimes. My feeling is that as development accelerates in the boreal forest, in some areas the anthropogenic impacts will dwarf the impacts caused by climate. So it remains to be seen.
Well, you know, of the things we've been talking about, one of the things that really interests me personally is the relationship of the forests and the permafrost. I've been to a lecture on permafrost melting. It's a long, slow process, but, you know, you get these things like drunk forests where the trees fall over because their whole root systems have been disturbed by the melting of the permafrost.
Yeah, and I think we can expect to see much, much more of that in the upcoming years. And it'll be very interesting to see how fires tend to burn in those areas. Some of them have meters of peat accumulation, and it's one thing to observe, study, fight a fire that you can see, but a fire that's burning underground, just smoldering deep in the peat with pretty much no smoke, well, that's another ball game altogether.
What are you going to be working on next, Mark?
I'm going to be working on predicting fire refugia. So I want to know these parts of the boreal forest that almost never burn or that burn not as intensely. I think that these areas can act as holdovers or stepping stones for a lot of the species of plants and animals as the landscapes, the regions around them change very rapidly.
That sounds really worthwhile to me. Our guest has been Canadian forest research scientist Marc-André Parisien. He is an author on the new paper, Resistance of the Boreal Forest to High Burn Rates, and that's published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and the official data publication is August 4th, 2014. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Join us next week on Radio EcoShock. Get links to stories in our programs this week from our show blog at ecoshock.info. You can find all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Don't forget about our SoundCloud page. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world. As we close out this week, the United Nations Framework on Climate Change Press Room is running a weekly platform for climate music. One Radio EcoShock song has already been chosen, Time of Trials. You can find that on SoundCloud. I heard the lyrics for this next song by a Swedish writer calling himself Climate Man. You can hear all his music at climatesongs.com. We got in touch by email, and I agreed to produce a new electronic remix of his song, CO2 Society. You can find that version on my Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page to download it or share it for free, of course.
Hypnotize me, empty out my brain. Your stupid arguments are really all the same. We've been living far too long with the shame. End CO2, climate action for real. We deserve it, we deserve it. So we look our children's eyes, proud and free of shame. Proud and free, proud and free. CO2 society, it's time for you to go. Time to go, time to go. We've seen enough of your empty, pointless show. The CO2 society, it's time for you to go. You came with your wealth and glamour, but that was long ago. Now your tatty times are through. CO2 society, it's time for you to leave. Spare our children's children from what would be. Cause you're wasting their future degree by degree. You don't need your climate catastrophe. For sure. We want climate action, that's for real. We want to look in our children's eyes, proud and free of shame. CO2 society, it's time for you to go. Time for you to go. Time for you to go. We've seen enough of your planet killing show. CO2 society, it's time for you to go. Time for you to go. Time for you to go. Time to go. Go, go, it's time for you to go. Carbonate, go, go, it's time for you to go. Carbon society, go, go, it's time for you to go. Carbon society, go, go, it's time for you to go. Carbon society, go. go. It's time for you to go. Carbonage. Time for you to go. Go, go. Time for you to go. Bankers and billionaires. Time for you to go. Carbon power. Time for you to go. Time's up. Go, go. It's time for you to go. Carbonage. Time for you to go. Go, go. Time for you to go. Bankers and billionaires. Time for you to go. Carbon power. Time for you to go. Time's up. Go, go. It's time for you to go. Carbonage. Time for you to go. Go, go. Time for you to go. Bankers and billionaires. Time for you to go. Carbon power. Time for you to go. Time's up.